Time to take a look at your pet's health. Hi, Larry Mueller here. My guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her back, and thank you so much for listening in today. You may have a question about your pet, your pet's health, or maybe just a general question about pet health. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a picture or also a question on my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here on Valentine's Day.
Yeah, and just in time for Valentine's Day, you've got a new smartphone app for us.
Well,
Chalk Talks.
You know, we get phone calls all the time. Hey, you know, my dog just ate a couple of chocolate chips or ate some baking chocolate or whatever. We actually use an online, there's a veterinary source called VIN, Veterinary Information Network, and they have a chocolate calculator on there. But now there's one for an owner to use on their cell phone and smartphone. It's called Chalk Talks, C-H-O-C-T-O-X. If you know what your dog weighs, you know what kind of chocolate they ate, whether it be milk chocolate, dark chocolate, baking chocolate, whatever, and approximately how much, you just plug that in, press calculate, and it tells you whether it's a big emergency or not. I would always be recommending that you contact your veterinarian, but it kind of gives you an idea as, you know, is this something that, you know, I have to be like really rushing to get in or making my dog vomit at home. So it's just a nice one to have. And I've used it a couple of times already with patients calling me.
Is that right?
Yes.
And it worked quickly and.
Oh yeah. Like very, you know, very fast. And it's like, yeah, you better get your dog in right now. So yeah.
There you go. Well, Jenny in Chicago has a question for you. So let's go to Jenny. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, Doctor.
You're welcome.
Well, we have a concern about our cat, whose name is Mama, and she's about 7 years old. She's been to the vet twice about this. We thought it was her teeth, because every now and then and again she would howl and sort of hold her head down like she couldn't bear the pain. So, and we would hear her grinding her teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had a cleaning. She had one tooth removed. So we thought the problem was solved, but she wouldn't eat. They put her on antibiotics. And then, we did the course of antibiotics, and then so we thought she was a little better. And then she became very listless, wouldn't eat, and then she would do that howling again.
Weird, weird.
And so we took her back, and they thought it was some sort of a virus, maybe.
Huh.
Like
yeah.
A herpes-type thing. They said her throat was very raw.
Okay. Yeah, whenever a pet's in for dentistry, a couple of things that you want to be asking. And since February is Pet Dental Health Month, it's a great first call. Yes. This is a month when veterinarians like to, you know, which we should be doing all year round, but promote dental care for our pets. When you have your pet in for dentistry, obviously, if your pet was acting strange and uncomfortable and was going to be anesthetized for a good oral exam, I hope that they did some lab work to make sure that your pet is healthy and happy and doesn't have any other organ problems that could be causing her not to eat or feel uncomfortable. Sometimes, you know, cats will drool excessively with liver disease. Go figure, you know. So you think it's their mouth, but it's actually they drool excessively sometimes with different forms of liver disease. So getting lab work done first to ensure safe anesthesia. And then find out if what they do when they clean the teeth. It should be done using like an ultrasonic scaler and then getting up underneath the gum line. And each tooth should be treated as an individual. And getting x-rays done is probably your best way of seeing if there are other, you know, painful teeth there, because it's sometimes very difficult to know what's going on, whether you've got any root damage or anything like that. So just like we get screening x-rays done, we can do the same thing for dogs and cats as well. Now, I know not every vet clinic has x-ray capability to be able to do dental care that way, but that would be probably in your cat's best interest. If your veterinarian feels that, you know, it's probably the mouth, you may want to go in and have those teeth looked at. There's a condition that cats get that's given the name resorptive lesions, where they get these something like cavities in their teeth, but it's not like a cavity that we get. And they can sometimes be under the gum line, and it's easy to miss. And so it's something that you may have to go back to your veterinarian and say, hey, you know, should we go to a specialist to have this mouth looked at again? I'm concerned, too, if they did see some changes in the tissues in the mouth. Cats can get oral cancers and have problems that way too. And any abnormal tissues while they're in the mouth, cleaning the teeth up and removing diseased teeth or treating them, whatever needs to be done, that tissue should be biopsied as well. So, I'm not sure what was done, you know, during the procedure, but those would be questions to ask your veterinarian, you know, if they did take x-rays, did they biopsy? And if not, you know, is it possible to have that done?
That was done. And then he had, given her Clindacure. Are you familiar with that?
Clindamycin is an antibiotic that we use.
Yeah,
clindamycin is an antibiotic that works very well on the oral flora. And so when we have, like, I just had a dog in yesterday that had a freshly fractured one of its big main chewing teeth, and it's going in to see the dentist that I refer my things to at the vet clinic in a few days. And so just to prevent infection, we started the dog on some clindamycin, and it seems to be a fairly well tolerated antibiotic. When it comes to viral infections in cats, you can get like oral ulcerations and things with herpes. Typically when they have a recurrence of a herpes virus, like herpes just never leaves the body once they get infected, it's usually the eyes where we'll see problems. They'll get corneal ulcers and ocular changes rather than having problems in the mouth. So I'm really question viral being the cause of this.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Jenny. I want to give Shannon a chance to join in. Shannon, hello to you.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sandy. Thanks
hello.
For taking my call.
Sure.
Larry, I listen to your show every day, and I really enjoy it, and I've learned a lot of useful information.
Well, good. Well,
thank you.
Ma'am. Sandy, my question is, I have a 12-year-old Maine Coon who, in his older age, the last year or two, once or twice a month, he's throwing up bile. And we've taken him to the vet, and he's had blood tests done, and the vet really doesn't say anything, doesn't say that's normal or let's explore further. And so I'm just wondering, is that okay for him to be doing this once or twice a month?
Well, it's not uncommon for pets if they have an empty stomach. Let's say, you know, they go to sleep and they haven't eaten anything before going to bed, to sometimes get a little bit of bile reflux and, you know, up comes a little bit of bile-colored fluid. You have to kind of look at the big picture, though. If this is a new thing for your cat, it hasn't done it before, and it's now starting to do this, if it's accompanied by anything else, like, you know, if that they found on physical exam, like especially weight loss or changes in the stool that's coming out, appetite, then it, you know, obviously warrants further investigation. Lots of things can cause a cat to vomit. It could be, I mean, the range is everything from parasites, and even indoor cats can be potentially exposed to parasites. There's a stomach worm called Physalopteria that can be picked up from eating bugs and things, and a lot of cats like to do that. You know, the worst on the list would be, you know, cancer or something like that. So I think, you know, if your veterinarian has not done any further investigating, like, you know, they did some lab work. Was that correct?
They did blood test, and they also did a fecal exam looking for parasites.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
He usually is throwing up that bile in the middle of the night.
Okay.
And so that very well could be that he's not really eating before bed. And
yeah. So you may want to try, I mean, a simple thing would be to try to feed him something tasty before he goes to bed and just see if that makes a difference. And, you know, and if it doesn't, then it's time to jump to the next level. And this is what I call the, you know, gastrointestinal extravaganza, you know, getting an ultrasound done of the abdomen, x-rays, maybe a barium swallow, scoping, biopsies, you know, going all down that road, and hopefully just feeding your cat before bed may be all you need to do.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Shannon. Sylvia in Evansville, on to you now. Hi.
Again, thank you so much for taking my call, Larry and Sandy.
You're welcome.
I have a kind of perplexing problem, and typically I would take him immediately to the vet school, but I'm not possible to do that right now financially.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 10-year-old cat bunker. He was a foundling. I've had him for over 5 years. He's a gem. But a while ago in December, he was having some upper respiratory problems. Brought him to the vet, was put on a course of antibiotics. He seemed to resolve. And then in February, it seemed to recur, and he was having small spit-ups. So I thought, well, this is long hair. He likes to groom. I'll brush him more. But then he had problems straining stool, like he assumed the position for defecating.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have occasionally pencil-thin stool.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a decrease in appetite. So I brought him back to the vet. And basically what they did is an x-ray.
Uh-huh.
And what was most perplexing, I mean, it was jaw-dropping. His entire gastrointestinal system from his esophagus to his colon is dilated.
Whoa.
His esophagus is about two times bigger, wider than it should be.
Okay.
His tummy seems to be okay. His small intestine is only slightly enlarged. The esophagus is huge. It's got tortuous kind of little folds. But his colon is enormous.
Huh.
But he's passing
okay.
This pencil-thin stool. So he's... it was kind of a mystery. I know that they mentioned echo and exploratory surgery where they could do a biopsy. It's just right now I'm really constrained. So yeah. He's on a course of metoclopramide.
Metoclopramide, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm giving him injections every 8 hours.
Okay.
He's also on an antibiotic to see over a week if anything else that might be some help.
Yeah.
His appetite, I have him on AD, and he is eating now.
Okay.
If I give it to him so that he has to lick it down, I don't
mm-hmm.
give it to him in clumps.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, are there any other things I might try, or do you have any inkling as to what this autonomic collapse might be due to?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And there is a syndrome that we do see in cats where this will happen, where, you know, all of a sudden, suddenly just to have this nerve damage done to their intestinal tract. But other things that we'd want to be looking into would be, you know, is his potassium level normal? You know, looking into, you know, getting some lab work done that way. I think if, you know, and that in itself is not that expensive. And if it's just a matter of, boy, you know, his potassium level is low and it's causing GI stasis, which would be odd to have this esophagus be that big as well. I'm just concerned that, you know, when we have a cat who has what's called mega esophagus, they have the risk of aspirating food. When the esophagus is a muscular tube, and when we swallow, everything gets pushed into the stomach. But when it's all dilated like a big blown up balloon, everything just sits there. And then if he just lays in a certain position, food will just passively come right back up. He has no, and it's not vomiting. It's called regurgitation. And they run into the troubles with sometimes inhaling some of that. And then they can get pneumonias and have problems. So things that I'd be working on at home, if it was, you know, we're dealing with an animal with diagnosed megaesophagus, is feed them from an elevated position. Okay, so you have them stand up on their legs and you let gravity do its thing. Look at using various consistencies of food. Some animals do better with liquid diets, like milkshakey type consistency. Some do better with meatball type things. You know, some, it really varies depending on the animal. But, you know, the stool's coming out. If his colon's dilated, why is it coming out pencil thin?
Exactly.
And so does he have something obstructing his colon, a surrounding, you know, area stricture or something like that? Very, very strange. And I think you're doing what you can medically. Metoclopramide's a drug. It goes by the brand name of Reglan, and it's what's called a prokinetic agent. It helps keep everything moving in the right direction. Obviously, it's not going to work on the esophagus. It will work in the stomach. So continue what you're doing until you can get them in and have them looked at.
Yeah, and good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks so much for listening in. You can post on my Facebook page, if you have a question, maybe you have a picture of your pet you want to share, I'd love to see that too. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can do that. Call us at 800-642-1234. We had a Facebook question from Lucy wondering if it's dangerous for our dog to eat bird seed from the ground under the bird feeders, mm-hmm. or how about the corn in the deer feeder? She loves it and hasn't shown any side effects. So,
well, you know, a couple things we worry about. Anywhere there's bird seed on the ground, there's probably bird droppings, and birds can carry bacterial infections. Salmonella is one of the things that we get concerned about. And so, you know, dogs can be a little more resistant to it, but so far, so good. Your dog's doing fine. I have seen some dogs eat so much seed that they end up getting like an impacted intestinal tract filled with all this gritty, tight material. You know, when it comes to eating other animals' droppings, like rabbit droppings and deer droppings, probably not a big deal. But the one that we get really concerned about is raccoon droppings.
Oh.
And anytime you put corn out, I am sure that there's probably raccoons coming by,
sure.
and raiding the feeders and the corn and stuff at night. Raccoons, almost all of them carry a roundworm that's called Balanus ascaris. And it's just a common intestinal parasite in raccoons. They pass eggs in their stool, and those eggs, if a dog ingests the fecal material, it can be a problem for the dog. Some dogs, they'll actually, they may develop a full-blown roundworm infection, and then you're dealing with a dog where you could get sick. This is a parasitic egg that, when it turns into a larva, likes to migrate into strange places, but likes the brain, and it can be fatal. So, you know, really trying to keep your dog away from those areas is probably in your best interest and your dog's best interest, but that's kind of hard to do, you know, if you've got, you like to feed the birds. I have my bird feeders in my front yard because my dogs go out in the backyard, and they do the same thing, as, you know, snuff up all the bird seed. So I just thought, okay, well, I'll put it out front, and now I have it so I can look out my front window and see all my bird feeders.
There you go. Lori has a 20-year-old cat who's in good health, but she found pimples on his belly. They seem like blackheads. Don't seem to bother him. Wondering if they're normal or should I take him in for a bath or something?
Well, that is really odd. You know, I'm wondering if it's not nipples that are, sometimes they'll get kind of a little greasy discharge around the nipples, and sometimes they'll have inverted nipples, and you'll see these little black specks. It kind of depends on the size and location. But yeah, you know, that's kind of an odd thing to have. But 20-year-old cat, especially if they've lost hair on their belly, they may be a little greasier. They could get some pores getting plugged with material. If it's not bothering them, don't pick at it or, you know, anything like that. But next time you're in for a physical, have your veterinarian check it out.
Dan in Eagle River, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I'm calling about dog flea and tick medication, the topical stuff that I understand is systemic and turns the dog or the dog's blood into poison for fleas and ticks. Is this safe? And then is the dog still getting bitten by the fleas and ticks? And if that's the case, what do you have to do to keep the dog from coming down with things like Lyme disease that he might get from these tick bites? And I'll listen off the air.
Okay. Well, you've asked a lot of questions here. First of all, there's different types of flea control medications. There are products out there that are called adulticides, meaning that the adult flea jumps up and it will kill the adult flea. Some of them work faster than others, and some of the products you will see, the adult flea may be able to have had a meal before they died. And so some of the flea products also include what are called insect growth regulators, which are, the way I describe it to people is it's like a birth control pill for fleas. But it's really hard to get those little fleas to open their mouths and take their pill every day. So instead we mix it with their food, which is the dog's blood. Now these are very safe chemicals that are, they alter kind of hormonal regulation in the flea, but have absolutely no effect on mammals at all. There's one called Lufenuron that you'll sometimes see in some of the oral flea medications and heartworm preventatives. There's other ones called Methoprene is another very common one that you'll find in something like Frontline Plus. And what that will do then is if the flea happens to bite and lay eggs, the eggs won't hatch. And so it kind of still stops the life cycle. There is one orally given adulticide that goes by the brand name of Comfortis. And it also is mixed with a heartworm preventative now, and it goes by the brand name of Trifexis. And what that is an oral flea killer. So when the flea bites, it dies very quickly. And that lasts for a month, and it's given orally. And again, very safe for dog use. We do see some problems if you start mixing other drugs with it, namely off-label use of ivermectin at higher levels. So safe with heartworm preventative, but you wouldn't want to be, you know, mixing up your own concoctions or treating your dog for mites or something like that. So they all are very safe medications. I like to see people use a combination of an adulticide and an insect growth regulator when we're controlling fleas. And your question about, you know, do the fleas have to bite? Well, you know, if you've got a dog that's flea allergic, that's why you need to use something like an effective adulticide, because you want to try to kill the fleas before they start biting, because the bite, injection of the flea saliva, is what triggers the allergic reaction. So, you know, for tick control, I see you're up in a northern part of the country, of the state, where lots and lots of ticks are. There's a new product out by the Mariel company, and it's basically an improved frontline, and it's called CertiFect. It has a much more rapid tick killing effect than many of the other products that are out there. In the past, when we would put stuff on dogs, a lot of times the ticks would be able to attach and start feeding and often die before they could transmit things like Lyme disease, but we still sometimes would see some breakthrough. What this product does is it doesn't allow the ticks to attach. They kind of start dancing around, and it affects their nervous system, and they fall off. So that might be something to talk to your veterinarian about, is switching, if you are using Frontline, to try switching to something like CertiFect, and that might give you a little bit better tick control.
Is that
CERTA, CertiFect. Yeah.
FECT, probably. Yep. Okay. Andre in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hello, Andre.
How you doing this morning, Larry?
Great. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have two questions.
Okay.
I have a little lap dog, and his breath is just, my God, deplorable. I mean, mm-hmm. you don't even want to get his face near your face. It's that bad.
Okay.
And I was wondering if there was anything that I could do to get rid of that bad breath. And the second question is, why is chocolate so bad for our dogs?
Oh,
and
okay.
My answer's off the air.
All right.
Thanks, Andre.
Well, the chocolate question's easy to answer. There are stimulants in chocolate, just like there are in, you know, it's similar to caffeine. And dogs just process it very differently. And so if you've ever drank too much coffee or had too much soda and kind of get a little jittery, you get the idea of what you're seeing, but magnify that many, many fold for dogs. And it's just because they're not humans. They're a different species. So what's safe for us is not necessarily safe for dogs. I mean, and that goes, the same is true for like raisins. I mean, I just had some raisins before I came on the show. And yet if a dog ate what I did, they could go into kidney failure. So again, it's up to you as a pet owner to know what's safe for you to be able to feed your dog, especially if you like to share things from the table. So that's an easy question to answer. The bad breath question, my guess is that your dog has severe dental disease. I go in twice a year to get my teeth cleaned, and I get x-rays done pretty much once a year. And I'm always amazed. I mean, I brush every day, and I floss, and, you know, use rinses and things like that. And they still find, I hear them click, 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 getting the tartar off. And I would bet that you don't brush your dog's teeth, and that your dog probably has some pretty bad, periodontal disease going on. So going into your veterinarian and saying, my dog's breath is bad, let's get this looked at. And, you know, start with a clean plate, which means, good dental prophy, examining each teeth, treating any periodontal pockets that you may have, extracting diseased teeth, and then getting on a good home hygiene program. And there's no simple thing that you're going to do to make your dog's breath better. I've had people do things like they make these things called, like these dog mints called Yip Yaps. And they're like, well, I'm just going to give my dog these. That'll make the breath smell better. That'd be like you having rotten teeth and putting a certs or, you know, breath mint in your mouth. It may temporarily make your breath smell better, but it's going to come right back again. So time to take your dog into the vet clinic.
Julie in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a, I'm fostering a beagle, and she has a urinary issue. She has to be on SO food all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And is there anything else besides a prescription diet that she can have? I've taken, you know, she's on the dry food. We got her pH down to 6. Still has some crystals.
Mm-hmm.
No blood or bacteria in the urine. That was as of our last vet visit with her.
Yeah.
And I take the canned food and I freeze it into little dollops for treats.
Okay.
But is there anything else that she can have?
It's going to depend on what kind of stone she's been diagnosed with. The diets that we feed, we can feed a pet, really depends on you know, finding out what the stone is. And so if she's had a history of bladder stones, most veterinarians will then, you know, if they are removed surgically, send them in for analysis. And by having them analyzed, they can see what they're made up of. The two most common types of stones that dogs get are either struvite, which is the S in the SO diet, or oxalate. Both of them require kind of, those stones require different things to make them grow. Dogs that develop oxalate stones, they like to form in an acidic environment. They like a lot of mineral being passed, like calcium and things like that. And then the dogs that like to form struvite stones will often make them if their urine is more alkaline, so the higher pH. And so most of these prescription diets are going to give you a moderate pH and are like a little bit, you know, restricted in some of the minerals and things that are used to make up these bladder stones. I'd be really hesitant to, you know, be pulling her off of this food. I mean, I'm sure the odd treat once in a while wouldn't be a big deal. But first of all, go back to your veterinarian and say, what type of stone did my dog have? And then that will help you with knowing whether you can give her, like, you know, carbohydrate-based treats or whether, you know, you can give her, you know, higher protein things. A lot of variability that way. So back to the veterinarian with that question.
There you go.
Is there a difference between the SO and the SD diet?
Yes. SD diet is a stone dissolving diet. It's specific for struvite stones. It is a diet that's extremely high in salts and things to make the dog produce really, really dilute urine. And so it basically dissolves the stones. It will not have any effect on oxalate stones. And so the SD diet is a stone dissolving diet. And then once the stones are dissolved, it's not a diet that dogs can be stay on forever because it's very poor in mineral content. It's just a short term, a month or two to get those stones to dissolve depending on the size of them, and then we switch them over to a maintenance diet to keep the stones from reforming. And that's where things like the SO diet comes in, or sometimes a Hills, but that SO diet I believe is by Waltham makes that one, but there's you know, Hills has their own diets out there too. I think there's one called CD Multi, so lots of different ones that are out there, and it kind of depends on which brand your veterinarian carries in their clinic.
Yeah, there you go, Julie. Thank you for calling. As long as we're on diet, we have a Facebook question from Wendy, who says, we are adopting an 8-week-old Sheltie puppy. The puppies were weaned to a raw food diet. What are the benefits of keeping her on this diet? And if it's not necessary, what's the best way of weaning her to a more regular dog diet?
Well, I'll answer the easy part first, and that's the end of the question, is weaning a dog from one diet to the next. Just do it slowly. Just start adding a little bit of the new food to the old food and gradually make the diet change over. The switch to raw food diet, this has become a really controversial area in the pet world, and we kind of have, you know, veterinarians and pet owners kind of on in different camps, and I tend to take a real middle of the road look, and I think that as long as you're doing it safe, I don't think that there's really a nutritional benefit from one over the other. But people will say, you know, my dog looks better, their coat looks better. But to be honest with you, there is no documented evidence out there. We need to start seeing some research being done by veterinary nutritionists to actually prove some of the things that are out there online that people that like to use raw food diets are promoting. If you're feeding a raw food diet, be really careful with handling utensils. Make sure that that you wash them in a different sink than your own dishes. Kind of handling like how you would do raw chicken. You know, you have to be really careful with things. Handle the stool carefully because the risk of salmonella and E. coli. Make sure that it is a well-balanced diet, and that's where a lot of these raw diets fall down, is that people will start with a recipe and then gradually shift away. To give you an example, if the recipe calls for using pork loin and all of a sudden you decide to switch to pork chops, you've now decreased the protein level and increased the fat level in the diet. So you have to stick with the recipe. And one of the places that I have people go to if they do want to feed a raw food diet is there's a website called balanceit.com. It's run by veterinary nutritionists. They will formulate and help you with formulating a raw food diet if that's what you wish to use. And they also will provide the correct supplements and so on and help you with that. So that's a good place to go. And there are other places out there too. But, personally, I just don't have time. I barely have time to cook for myself, let alone to be making a diet for the dog. And
it has to be done right, as you say.
It has to be done right, or you're going to end up with long-term problems, and especially with a growing puppy.
Jeanette in La Crosse, we are turning to you. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. I have an almost 15-year-old Yorkie, and we took her in for her yearly dental blood work, and then they noticed that one of her liver enzymes was 3 times the normal level. So they the vet said to bring her back fasting, took another blood level. That came out fine, but after she'd eaten, that blood level is elevated also. And she was thinking that what she should do is give her a sonogram, and then depending on what that showed, maybe do a needle aspiration of the liver, or maybe even take a little biopsy of it.
Yeah. Do you know which liver enzyme was elevated? Do you know which one?
A something?
Alkaline phosphatase or ALT?
I think it's ALT. Okay. Not the one that would show pancreatic problems. Not that one.
Okay. Well, ALT is an enzyme that is released when liver cells are being damaged for some reason. And sometimes we can see that become mildly elevated with dental disease. Sometimes we will see that with a sick liver, if they've got some infiltrative disease in their liver or something like that. And so it sounds like your veterinarian's doing, going right by the book, retesting lab work, seeing what's going on. And in a 15-year-old dog, the easy thing to do would be to have a look at the liver, doing an ultrasound, and needle biopsies of the liver, even though it sounds like, oh my goodness, putting a needle in the abdomen, sometimes can give you answers, especially if you see a nodule or something in the liver. A skilled ultrasonographer can actually, using the little ultrasound probe on the outside of the belly, direct the needle right into where that is and collect cells directly from the problem spot. So that might be something you'd want to consider doing. An ultrasound is, like I said, non-invasive. The worst part for your dog is she has to have her belly shaved because she can't have hair on the belly, so she's going to look a little funny with her belly being shaved like that.
There you go. Thanks, Jeanette, for calling. Diane in Oshkosh, turning to you next. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because, I had a Sheltie, but from the time she was 3 to 4 months old, when she ran with the breeder's dogs, she was getting out of breath.
Mm-hmm.
So, I thought maybe just because she was out of shape compared to them who ran all day long, every day. But then this continued, and I took her to the vet because I was worried about heart disease and stuff because sometimes she also foamed at the mouth and vomited and stuff.
Okay.
And nothing. Everything's fine. And this has gone on since early last spring. And even when I took her in December to my regular vet because of the concern, she gets out of breath. Her tongue turns blue. She has a lot of a hard time breathing.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
She's running.
Yeah,
So there was a thing going on for another vet practice that has an exercise yard next to it.
Uh-huh.
So I decided, you know, because the other vet doesn't have any place where I could run her so that they could see it, and her heart was perfect, the rhythm,
okay,
everything. And so I took her there, and they checked her out first, and everything was perfect, her heart, her lungs, her rhythm, you know, everything.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then once we took her outside, then you could hear the stridor.
Yeah.
And feel it's a partial laryngeal paralysis.
Yeah, the larynx, or your voice box, which mine is giving out on me as where the show's going on, you have your vocal cords in there, and when the vocal cords are not being, you know, pulled back when the dog's breathing and getting out of the way, they kind of hang like curtains and obstruct the normal airflow. And especially, I mean, if you've got a dog that's just sitting there quiet in a not, you know, a normal environment that isn't humid, where they're not expected to pant and, you know, get excited, a lot of dogs can live with laryngeal paralysis. Their voice may be different. They may have a little bit of hoarser bark. But the minute they start exercising and have to move more air, it starts becoming a problem for them. They just can't get enough air in. And if that's the diagnosis, and the way we make the diagnosis is not only by, you know, listening to the dog and seeing what happens and historically, but to give them a very light anesthetic, a little bit, enough so that you can get their mouth opened and get in there with what's called a laryngoscope and actually watch as they're breathing to make sure that those vocal folds are moving back and forth. I had a dog in a couple of years ago that we thought maybe had laryngeal paralysis because it presented exactly the same way, and it ended up having cancer of its larynx. We were very surprised we went in and saw that. So there are other things that may be there besides just having laryngeal paralysis. So you really do need to get a diagnosis. If you find that that's what it is, then there is surgery that can be done. It's called a laryngeal tieback. Yeah.
Well, one vet thinks that, you know, don't do it because of the asphyxiation problem and the pneumonia.
Yeah, they are more at risk for choking and things like that. And that's where, if you can get by with just not having your dog exercise much, keeping them inside when that's air conditioned, not letting, you know, in air conditioning in the summer, not letting them get excited.
Yeah.
They may be able to live with it if you can adjust their environment, but ultimately you're looking at, you know, if your dog is turning blue, doing some surgical intervention.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Diane. Thank you. Jeff in River Falls, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks for calling.
See, I have about a 5-year-old Rottweiler, and she's a wonderful little dog, and she's a runt, actually, so she's about 55 pounds. But occasionally she gets obsessively eating grass or weeds or whatever is sticking up out of the snow, trying to regurgitate something out of her stomach. And even if she's in the house, she'll lick the carpet obsessively. And, of course, this always happens at night, so I'm up with her. And I haven't really been able to find a solution to this. We've been to the vet, and they've recommended Pepto-Bismol and things like that, but nothing seems to work. This happens about once every week or two.
Oh, that's fairly frequent to be having that going on. Dogs eat grass for a number of reasons. Some of them just like a salad now and then, but it sounds like your dog is doing it because, you know, she knows that it's a purgative and it's going to help her vomit. I'm going to just be a little stickler for terminology here. Vomiting is an active process that involves, you know, retching, abdominal press, and, you know, everybody's vomited at one point in their life, so you know what that is. But regurgitation is passive. It's just you open your mouth and up stuff comes, and it's like it doesn't require any abdominal press or anything like that. And we'll usually see that when we have esophagus problems, like a problem called megaesophagus or a dilated esophagus. So your dog is vomiting, not regurgitating. And then, you know, so something is making your dog nauseous. And if it's happening at night, it could just be, like we talked about with this other one of the other callers, a problem with like a little bile reflux or something. And if you don't want to jump in and say, let's go through the gastrointestinal extravaganza, I would recommend trying to feed your dog a little bit of food before bedtime so that they've got something in their tummy to work on. So save some of her dinner back and then give it to her before bed. You may want to talk to your veterinarian about using something like a little Pepcid or something like that. They can figure out a dose for you that's available over the counter. We use medical that drug very commonly in dogs. It's called famotidine is the chemical name. Sometimes we'll use an agent called Reglan or metoclopramide. I'm a little hesitant to jump in and use that medication unless I've done some workup, because if there is any and gastrointestinal obstruction, that drug could be problematic. So, but I think trying to feed her a little bit before bed, that may make you have a good night's sleep once in a while then. So,
I think she'd appreciate that.
Okay. All right.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about your dog or your cat's health, I hope you'll join in with our guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She'll have some answers for you at 1-800-642-1234, or go to my Facebook page. You can post a question or photo. We always get lots of photos. Actually, there's a photo of Sandy and myself and Judith somewhere on that page.
Yeah, I think that was taken last month.
Yeah, last month. We have CJ and Eau Claire with a question for you, so let's go there now. Hi, CJ.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great.
I'm from Eau Claire. I've got a blue pit about 3 years old, and she's got a torn, we took her into the vet. She's got a torn ACL.
Okay.
And they got her on this ibuprofen for dogs that's like $70-some prescription. Is there anything like over-the-counter we could give her?
Yeah.
The vet said that she had a lab that had the same problem.
Uh-huh.
And she had the surgery done. They said there's a surgery they can do to repair the ACL. But she said she did the same thing to her lab, and it still limps. It still has the pain. So she said we can do it, but sometimes it's not the best thing to put the dog through. Is there anything over the counter? A couple people have told us, like baby aspirin or something.
Yeah, you got to be really, really careful with interchanging dog medications with human medications. I'm going to just back up here and just talk about anterior cruciate ligament ruptures. Anytime you rupture, change, the dynamics of a joint, even if it's done by the best surgeon, it's going to make the dog better, but it's not what Mother Nature gave. So they're going to be prone to probably developing still some arthritis and so on. There's lots of different surgical procedures out there. I would want to do a little homework before trusting what your veterinarian says, because I happen to disagree. I think that by telling you not to do the surgery that's not going to make any difference is absolutely wrong. I think you need to be, informed as to the different types of surgery that are available to be able to repair this. And this would be something that a orthopedic surgeon should be able to talk to you about to find, let you know, the pros and cons on all the different types of surgery that can be done. Don't say you're not going to have surgery done. Is it expensive? Yes. Is it going to buy your dog better quality of life? Yes, and my dog, Bulldozer, is proof of it. About when he was about four, jumped off my pier at my cabin in Northern Ontario and landed on the rocks and traumatically tore his anterior cruciate. He is now 9 years old and runs around. And, yeah, he's got a little arthritis in that leg, but, boy, he's a happy, happy dog. So if I hadn't done it, I would have had a three-legged dog and his life would have been miserable. Pain medication while you're waiting to have surgery done, it's something that, your dog is probably going to have to be on something, especially if you don't do surgery, for the rest of their life. And the difference between the veterinary drugs and things that humans use, our aspirin tends to be, for dogs, very ulcerogenic. You give aspirin to a dog, very good chance that they're going to develop a gastric ulcer. The other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that we use in dogs can still do the same thing. We always want to give it with food, but to a much less degree, much safer for long-term use. So I would not recommend using aspirin. Switching to something like ibuprofen, the therapeutic dose is so close to the toxic dose in dogs that even though we use a drug in dogs that sounds like ibuprofen, one called carprofen, different thing. And it does, you know, again, it's going to be safer. But anytime we've got dogs on these drugs long term, there is going to be some monitoring involved where we want to check lab work and make sure that kidneys and liver are doing okay. Because any of these drugs, even though they're very great help, can also cause damage in the long run. So you've got to, you know, some dogs like, well, my other dog, Vanna, she's on carprofen on a daily basis. She gets it twice a day, and she gets it with right after breakfast and right after dinner, and it's made all the difference in her comfort level. She has shoulder and elbow arthritis and really has a hard time getting around, and boy, this has made her, you know, be a new dog again. So places where you can go to get less expensive medications, you could talk to your veterinarian about ordering it online. There are, if you're using something like Rimadyl, there is a generic version of carprofen or Rimadyl for dogs, and I'm drawing a blank on it right now. But if you just enter, you know, generic Rimadyl for dogs, you'll find it'll pop up, and you can get it at many of the veterinary pharmacy sites like Foster and Smith in northern Wisconsin, or PetMed Express, or some of those places as well. So you may want to do a little shopping and see if you can get a little cheaper.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Dalton and Mosini, we are turning to you now. Hi, Dalton.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, you see, I have this Sheltie. It's a miniature Sheltie.
Okay.
And she's one day she was running next to our shed, and she hurt her leg or something, because on her back leg, she's got this bump. It's a big bump, and we don't know what it is. It's on the other side, but on the other side, it's smaller.
Huh. Very strange. Anytime we get a bump in, like a bump, an animal coming in, we don't get a bump in. We get an animal with a bump coming in. Yes, okay. Besides just having, you know, feeling it and getting an idea, does it feel fluid-filled? Is it hard? What is it attached to? The next step would be then putting a very fine needle into it and taking some of the cells out of it and looking under the microscope to see what it's made up of. To see if there's infection there, whether there's cancer cells, whether it's, you know, just, you know, any, you know, other like normal tissue like fat cells or something like that. So if you're wondering what it is, I think a visit to your veterinarian is going to give you more answers than me trying to help you. I wish I could, but I have no idea. If it was trauma related, that's, you know, if it happened with a bump, sometimes we will, you know, see scar tissue and things like that building up, but it just would be odd to be on both legs and yeah, be hard like that. So get it checked out.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Dalton, for calling. And Kay in Prairie du Sac, hello to you.
Hi. I have an almost 6-year-old Border Collie mix, and I have been giving, he's moderately active. I've been giving him human glucosamine chondroitin.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the 1500, 1350, 1250, and it also has vitamin C. And I break that in half, and he gets a half every day.
Okay.
And so I want to know about that dosage and if it's okay, and as he gets older, should he get more?
Well, that sounds like a pretty appropriate dose. I always have to, you know, say that with a word of caution, because I still, you know, go back and check dosages. But that sounds like approximately what we'd be using. It's very safe. It's a dietary supplement. I was at a meeting a few years ago, and there was somebody that was doing a lot of research on some of these supplements. And one of the things that I took away from this that I remember her saying is that there's more glucosamine chondroitin sulfate sold in the United States than manufactured. So what does that mean?
Yeah.
That means that there are some supplements out there because they don't have the same checks and balances as other drugs that are used because it's considered a nutraceutical, that you may be not getting what you think you're giving to your dog. So this would be a time to, you know, talk to either your veterinarian and say, what brand do you recommend? And many of the brands that we, you know, we use in our clinic, I know that one of the brands, Cozaquin, is one that we've had in our clinic. They now sell at Target, so it's available over the counter. And, you know, so find out or even ask the human pharmacist, you know, if you had to pick one of these supplements, which company would you trust? And the company that I like, if I'm looking for just a glucosamine chondroitin sulfate supplement, is a company called Nutramax. And they actually make a human and a dog product. And for, you know, the human product is called Cozamin. The dog product's called Cozaquin. And they tend to be a very reputable company and make a number of other supplements as well. So check with the pharmacist the next time you're in and say, would this be one that I'd take? Because sometimes, you know, if it's priced nice and low, you may not be getting a good product.
Mm. There you go.
Do they need more as they get older?
Not necessarily. I would just stay at a recommended therapeutic dose. And so, you know, the next time your dog's in to be weighed at the vet clinic, say, this is what I'm giving him. Is it the right dose? And so it's all, you know, weighed according. But, you know, a large breed dog, what you just said, that's probably a pretty close dose.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Kay. Facebook question for Meredith. They have an 8-year-old Neapolitan Mastiff who has very dry skin. Gives her a vitamin E supplement every 3 days or so, which keeps her from chewing her tail to bleeding. And they use a humidifier, but she still constantly has a dry nose to the point of bleeding, sometimes even in the humid part of summer.
Yeah.
Anything to do
about
this?
Well, a lot of these dogs, like my bulldogs, they, and you know, many dogs have what's called a nasal hyperkeratosis, which is just excessive skin buildup on their nose, and it can be very dry and crusty and sometimes get irritated. So that may be what's going on. And there are some products that you can use that are, you know, over-the-counter products that will help soothe the nose and make it, you know, a little more comfortable. But most of the time, they shouldn't be bleeding. And there's another condition that sometimes affects middle-aged dogs that's called discoid lupus. And if, you know, if she's got problems with her skin and other places, boy, I think it'd be a good idea, even though the rest of the message said the dog doesn't like to go to the vet, it's time to see a veterinarian. If it means having a muzzle on your dog to be examined, that
so
was
it.
What we need to do.
All right. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and post a question or photograph there. She will be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're like me, the animals that are part of your family are important to you and you want to keep them healthy and happy. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine here for the next half hour to share new information and timely advice. And whether you're a lifelong pet owner or maybe adopting a companion for the very first time, I know that Sandy's ready to answer your questions. When you call at 1-800-642-1234, don't forget to check our Facebook page. You can post a question there. Love to see photos of pets, of your pet as well. And if you click like while you're there, we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. So please do that. And stay with us. We'll be back with Dr. Sandy right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. Thank you so much for listening in. And, Sandy, I know there's something called Perfect Pet Products that you're not happy about.
Oh, you see the hair standing up in the back of my neck here. this is a website where owners can go. It's operated by a veterinarian. It's called Perfect Pet Products. And you can order, as one of the tests, is an at-home heartworm test. So heartworm is checked by getting a blood sample. And so you mail off and they send you a mailing thing and a blood tube and you mail it back to them. How do you get the blood? Well, they say in their little infomercial on their website, there's a little video you can watch. You cut the dog's nail back to the quick and let it bleed into the tube. Okay?
Oh.
Now, that is going to be a dog that will not like to have its nails trimmed again. And I love the last words. They said, no pain, no gain. So, yes, you can get this done and send it off to a lab. But, it is going to be a problem for you and your dog. They also have a thing called the health checkup. And it's supposed to be, and when I started looking into it, it says, you know, looks and diagnoses, urination, infections, behavior problems, will help solve carpet urine odors and carpet urine stains, and you know, diagnose all these health problems. All it is a urine dipstick. It's a little stick that's got these little pads on it. You dip in the urine and you compare it to a color chart. So it's going to tell you what the pH of the urine is, whether there's sugar in the urine. And he is making a health screen on a urine dipstick. And I am just appalled that there is a veterinarian out there that's marketing this stuff. And let his lawyers attack me. But I'm just like, please, if it's too good to be true, it's probably too good to be true.
Deirdre, we are turning to you next. Thank you so much for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I have a 11-year-old cat who was diagnosed with renal failure, I think about 4 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I changed his diet over to the kidney food or whatever it's called. And he eats that strictly and no table scraps or anything. So his numbers have been getting better. And so I guess every time I go into the vet, I ask, you know, it seems like a really morbid question, but what am I supposed to be looking for to know if he's getting worse?
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to direct you to a website, and it's the International Renal Interest Society, IRIS.
Okay.
It's one that it's written for veterinarians, but there's also some good information for owners in there as well. And then there's another site that's called Feline CRF, which is felinechronicrenalfailure.com. And that's, again, an excellent site to know more than you ever wanted to know about kidney disease. What has me concerned is that if your cat's 11, your cat was diagnosed when it was 7 years of age, which is really uncommon. This is a fairly common old cat disease, but to have an 11-year-old cat that's had this for 4 years, you know, start wondering, did your kid get into some toxins? Do they have some underlying, you know, kidney problem like cystic kidneys or something? So without knowing what caused your cat's problem, and sometimes we have to, you know, go back in the history or get an ultrasound and look at the kidneys or get a biopsy of the kidneys or whatever to give you a better idea as to prognosis. But in general, when we diagnose kidney disease in an older cat, it's something that they can, with the right management, can often live with for years and do just fine. The things that you should be watching are definitely watch the diet, okay? And so you've got your cat on a kidney-friendly diet, which tends to be lower in salt, higher in potassium, a little bit lower in protein, you know, a little bit more energy because sometimes these cats don't like to eat as much. I'd also be making sure that you regularly have your cat check the cat's blood pressure checked, because many cats with kidney disease will become hypertensive, which just spirals the kidney disease out of control. And I recommend that being done at least twice a year, every 6 months, having blood pressure checked. And then, you know, besides that, and, you know, adding in supplements if needed, like if the potassium, even with the kidney diet, is dropping low, adding in a potassium supplement. Sometimes they have to go on phosphate binders to make them, you know, be a little more normal and feel better. So as things progress, those would be things that, you know, you're going to start seeing more and more medications maybe being added in. Probably one of the big kind of predictive factors that we can watch is the kidneys make a hormone that stimulates the bone marrow to make red blood cells. And when we start seeing these cats becoming anemic and their kidney values going up, that's a good indication that we're kind of coming to an end here. And, you know, with cats, you can do kidney transplant. I mean, they do tolerate it very well. If it's something that you're interested in, we do it at the vet school. The vet school also does dialysis now, so we do have a dialysis unit at the vet school as well. So there are other things that we can do to, you know, keep the cat comfortable and feeling good. Oh, lastly, make sure that you have them screened periodically for urinary tract infections, because a lot of times those can be brewing and you don't even know that they're there because they're peeing so much because of their kidney disease that they may have a urinary tract infection, which can get into the kidneys and then can, you know, make them sicker too. So typically every 6 months, I check blood pressure, lab work, blood cell counts and get a urine culture done and, mm-hmm. and see what's going on with these kitties and go from there. But 4 years, you're doing great. And
yeah,
hopefully you'll get
good.
Four plus more.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, he's pretty great.
Thank
good.
You. Thanks a lot for calling. And Steve in Winter, Wisconsin, on to you. Hi, Steve.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I've got a 8-year-old Border Collie, mix, and all of a sudden, last weekend, he went from one day to the next, not being able to walk because his rear right leg, his foot was curled under.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife was, you know, check this out. So I'm walking. I was watching him, and sure enough, he would walk with three legs, but he would favor that leg underside. And
okay.
then throughout the weekend, that was last Saturday. Throughout the weekend, Sunday, it seemed like it even spread to his other side.
Okay.
And when we would let him outside, he would go outside. He would do what he had to do outside, and he would obviously stumble. We have three steps he has to come in the house with. He would have a hard time coming up those steps, I suppose, probably from not being accustomed to walking that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that so that lasted for 2 or 3 days, and now I've noticed that he's back to form.
Huh.
But now he scraped off some of his hide from the other side, and we put bacitracin and wrapped it, and it has a slight odor to it. But mm-hmm. I think the upfront of my conversation here is that we noticed this. It seemed bad. Now it seems good. We have a little bit of odor with the yeah. foot. We're treating it. What next do you think?
Well, I'd love to know what caused it. It sounds like your dog had a neurologic problem. What you're describing is what we call knuckling, where they don't know where their feet are in space, and instead of standing with their pads on the ground, as they're walking, their foot will sometimes flip over and they'll walk on the top of their foot, which, as you found out, if they're walking on rough surfaces, can cause abrasions and be uncomfortable for them. So what caused it? Did your dog have a disc problem? Did they have a vascular accident to the spinal cord, you know, some other trauma that triggered this? But
it literally went from I chopped wood.
Yeah.
When I'm out there chopping wood, he won't let me work because he wants to take what I'm chopping, throw it in the air so he could go retrieve it. He literally went from that kind of motion, that kind of attitude one day to this the next day, and
yeah.
I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, well, so something hit his spinal cord and caused this problem, and I'm glad he's doing better. This would be something I'd be watching. A dog that has an acute onset like this without, you know, obvious back pain and gradually gets better over a few days, there is a problem called fibrocartilaginous emboli, which is where a little bit of the disc material gets into the blood vessels that supply the spinal cord, and it's almost like having a little mini stroke. And some of these dogs will get better, others will not get better. It kind of depends on the degree of severity of the obstruction. So I'm wondering, especially if your dog's, you know, does a lot of jumping and things like this, because this is something that's actually seen in like basketball players. They'll, you know, jump up to make a basket and land, and it just that jarring motion can sometimes trigger this. So I'm wondering if that's not what happened to your dog. Keeping that foot protected, making sure, you know, if there is an odor, bacitracin may not be enough. You may be looking at needing to get your dog on a systemic antibiotic to keep infection under control. And, you know, that would be something you would have to talk to your veterinarian about.
Mm-hmm.
All righty.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad
for
your
calling.
Dog's doing
yeah.
better.
Yes,
that's,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you again for calling. And Taylor in Appleton, let's give you a chance now. Hi, Taylor.
Hi. I'm just calling about, I have a 5-pound Yorkie mix. And when he was probably a little bit under 6 months, we had noticed that he was vomiting, whatever. We took him into the doctor, and they actually did liver shunt. They did tests of his bile acids.
Mm-hmm.
They did a liver shunt.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they determined that it's possible that he has one. They never told us what kind, but he has no clinical signs whatsoever of a liver shunt. But they do have him, on the Science Diet, the Hepatic Health.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, like, Is there anything that we can do to mix in some, like, a different kind of food? Like, is it necessary to continue him on the science diet food? I know yeah. there's a big push to get dogs onto food that's a little bit healthier, a little bit more all natural. I mean, is there anything out there that I can look for?
Well, if your dog truly has a shunt, what a shunt is... when we take in food, nutrients as well as, you know, different toxins and things get absorbed through the intestinal tract into the bloodstream, that blood vessel goes to the liver, and the liver removes all those toxins and things, ammonia and so on. And so if we have a shunt, what that means is that blood supply from the intestines to the liver, instead of going to the liver, it bypasses the liver and gets dumped right back into the general circulation. So dogs that are clinical with the shunt, after they've had a protein meal, they may become neurologic, they may seizure, they may be a little kind of demented and not all there. They're usually pretty skinny because the liver also takes the nutrients and turns it into things as well. So, you know, these dogs usually are runty and small, and the way we treat it is usually if we can diagnose where the shunt is, if it's a what we call an extrahepatic shunt, meaning outside the liver, you can sometimes go in and actually ligate the shunt, tie it off, and allow all the blood then to go back to the liver and turn them into a relatively normal dog. But sometimes the shunts are inside the liver, and then we're looking at all we can do is medical management. And so I'd be really hesitant to be switching your dog to a different diet, because these dogs that have a shunt have a really hard time dealing with excessive protein in their diet. And so it's usually a protein-restricted diet. And sometimes they even have to be on medications that help change the intestinal tract flora so that there's less ammonia being made. So sometimes they're on like an oral antibiotic or different things to kind of change what's going on in the intestinal tract. Switching to a different diet, if you wanted to go to maybe a homemade diet, I mentioned earlier this website called balanceit.com. There are other veterinary nutritionists out there that your veterinarian and yourself, you could work with. There's obviously a fee to help formulate a diet, but if you wanted to do like a homemade diet for your dog, they'd be able to come up with a recipe that would be appropriate for a dog that has a history of a liver shunt. So that would be the way to go, rather than just going over the counter and grabbing something because you may be causing your dog a lot of harm.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Lynn sent us a Facebook note, says, I'm a groomer in northern Wisconsin. We groom an older Lhasa that has developed terrible skin issues over the past 18 months. We only groom her once every couple of months and use natural shampoos, vinegar, and yogurt rinses to try to help the skin. Systemic yeast infection, very serious, getting worse. He's being treated by a vet, but the dog hasn't seen any improvement. The hypoallergenic food the vet recommended hasn't helped. Could this be a thyroid issue?
Yeah, you know, when we see skin problems like this that creep up in older animals, we definitely start wondering, you know, because most dogs that have allergies or have something like that, it starts when they're younger. You're going to start seeing changes, and there'll be maybe a little itchy when they're a couple of years of age. So the fact that it's an older dog and this has started, you start wondering, you know, what's going on with the dog's system. So a good physical exam, getting some lab work done, and then finding out exactly what's wrong with the skin. Is it a yeast infection? Is it a mite infection? Sometimes older dogs will have a recurrence of a mite called Demodex when they have some health-related issues. You know, is it a bacterial infection? And then treating appropriately. So I don't have enough information here from the groomer, obviously, to say, here's what needs to be done until, you know, she's mentioning yeast, but you know, is that really what's going on? So I think going back to the drawing board and say, let's, you know, recheck and see what's going on with the skin. We are seeing a lot of cases now because so many dogs have chronic skin problems and they're on antibiotic after antibiotic. We're seeing a lot of dogs with resistant bugs. As humans, we get MRSA infections, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Dogs get MRSAI, methicillin-resistant Staph intermedius. Once in a while, they can get the human form too. And so I've been doing a lot of culturing on dogs that have this as a problem because the standard antibiotics and things we use are not effective. If this dog really truly does have a yeast infection, I'd be looking at what medications are being used. The dog should probably be on a systemic antifungal drug, an oral medication on a daily basis to help get the yeast under control.
Along with that, we have an email from David who wonders about his dog who was recently diagnosed with having a thyroid deficiency. Are dogs able to take a generic medication designed for humans, or do they need one designed especially for canines for thyroid?
That's a really good question, because bioavailability of drugs, and this is true for any drug that we may consider using, it can vary between species. And so, you know, using one that is a, you know, dog product is probably, you know, in the dog's best interest. If you do decide you want to go to with a human medication, whenever we make a medication change, we like to recheck thyroid levels and make sure that we're still maintaining them in the at the same level. So if the thyroid level drops because of the medication, then that means it's probably not working as well. We better switch back to something else. So if you do make the switch, follow up with your veterinarian. And so usually we'll, you know, 4 to 6 hours post pill, we'll check another what's called a T4 level, simple little blood test, goes off to a lab, and we see where we're at.
There you go. Pat in East Troy, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sandy.
Hi.
I've called about this in the past, but I just wonder if anything has changed. I have a golden retriever who looks like a golden but acts like a bad Rottweiler. And she's on my lap right now. We get along fine in the house, but she has been on fluoxetine for 3 years every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything I could change her to, or is there anything wrong with continuing this?
Well, fluoxetine is a psychoactive drug. Most people recognize it more from the brand name Prozac. It's a serotonin reuptake inhibitor. It can be used very safely in dogs. In fact, there is a labeled dog product out now called Reconcile, that is a little meat flavored tablet. But, you know, dogs do very well. This happens to be one of the dog medications that the dog version, human version works very well in dogs, and they still bioavailable. You know, without having your behavioral diagnosis and, you know, what's been done from the behavior modification standpoint in front of me, I'm hard pressed to say that your dog needs a medication change. I'd be saying, you know, going back and saying, whoever prescribed it, is this working? Is it doing what you were hoping it would do? Typically, we'll prescribe fluoxetine for a number of behavior problems, but dogs that have compulsive disorders, dogs that, like, you know, chase their tail all the time, or shadow chase, or fly snap, or do weird things like that, where it's like an obsessive compulsive disorder. So that's one of the reasons we'll use it. We'll sometimes use it in dogs that have a problem with, you know, kind of out of control aggression. Because it does kind of normalize serotonin levels, and those can be a problem for some dogs. But it doesn't help with every kind of aggression. It may not help with a dog that's really fearful. You know, it may not help with a dog that's territorial. So, again, you've got to get a diagnosis. And if you haven't got one yet, 3 years, I think it's time.
Yeah.
So work with a behaviorist.
Thanks, Pat, for calling. Good luck to you. And Teresa in Waupun, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I just had a question about a 5-year-old dog that we have that has, it seems to be like a seasonal itching allergy.
Okay.
And it's just, I mean, we've noticed it more in the spring and the fall, and we did get some medicated shampoo to hopefully relieve some of her itching, but it just doesn't seem to help. So I didn't know if I should wait till she's actually having the itching and bring her back to the vet, or if there's something else that you can recommend.
Yeah, when we have dogs that are seasonally itchy or pruritic, it's usually because they have allergies, and it usually is something in the environment, a pollen or a mold or something that happens to be blooming at that time, kind of like the same reason why we get hay fever and problems that way. So things that you can do besides going through allergy testing and allergy shots and going all down that road, which is like kind of the gold standard standard would be antihistamines, some of the skin barrier stuff that helps. I usually have a product called, there's a line called Duoxo that has phytofungicin in it. Big name, but it helps with improving skin barrier. Sometimes special diets may help. There's one that Hills makes called DD, which is very high in fatty acids, and it helps modify the inflammatory response. You know, and like you said, shampoos, topical leave-in conditioners and things may be helpful as well. But, you know, if it's seasonal and you can manage it without, you know, jumping into big gun drugs, by all means, do it that way. But it may get, and usually dogs that are have allergies are going to seasonally get worse as time goes by.
Okay, great. Thank you
all
so
right.
much.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Don't have time to get Don from West Salem on, but he wonders about spray to help clean teeth.
Okay, I'm going to recommend that anybody that wants to know about dental products, there is a website you can go to that's the Veterinary Oral Health Council, VOHC. That is kind of the governing body. Veterinary dentists evaluate products that are out there and give you an idea of what works and what doesn't. The sprays that are out there have not been approved by VOHC yet. So do they work? No, not to my knowledge. They may have nice pretty pictures online, but again, if it's too good to be true, it's probably too good to be true.
Well, it's unfortunately not too good to be true to find out that we're at the end of the show here.
But I'll be back next month.
That's good. That's
second Tuesday. Yeah.
Second Tuesday of the month. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Tomorrow, David Drake, an associate or assistant professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension wildlife specialist, will be our guest to talk about Wisconsin wildlife and what to look for as the days get longer and warmer. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.